King Hezekiah's revival of true religion in the kingdom of Judah could not stop at restoring the true worship of Jehovah. We read this evening in 2 Kings 18, just as a means of refreshing our memories concerning the stark departure that Hezekiah's accession to the throne of Judah represented when compared to what his father had done before him, his father being Ahaz. So Hezekiah came to the throne, and as we have seen in the prior messages in this series, he set about immediately to reform the religion of the land, to restore the true worship of Jehovah. Now, that restoration was a crucial element of the revival in the land of Judah. It was even a prerequisite, you could say, for the work that was to follow it. But the young king understood that the establishment of the revival could not leave the practice of idolatry in place, that practice that his father had so thoroughly instituted in the land, to the extent that he went and copied an altar from Damascus and had a copy built to be used in the temple in Jerusalem. Hezekiah was mindful of the history, and he was mindful especially of the scene at Mount Carmel earlier in the history of the northern kingdom of Israel from the reign of Ahab. The northern kingdom of Israel was, as we could understand by the opening of 2 Kings 18, literally on its last legs when Hezekiah became the king of Judah, because he became the king of Judah in the third year of Hoshea, the king of Israel. Hoshea reigned 9 years in Samaria and was the last king of Israel. So Hezekiah was familiar with what had happened in prior generations, when a mysterious prophet by the name of Elijah came on the scene to confront Ahab and Jezebel and the priests and prophets of Baal in the great confrontation, the great contest at Mount Carmel, where Elijah won a great victory. Now, after that great victory, the prophet of Jehovah demanded that not one of those 850 priests and prophets of Baal should escape. He ordered them all to be gathered together and put to the sword. Queen Jezebel was furious at the news. But Elijah understood that the proclamation of the people on Mount Carmel that the Lord, He is the God, meant that all the advocates of that which was false must lose their lives. So after the tears of triumph in the great vindication on Mount Carmel, there had to follow the obliteration of the devotees of the idolatry that had brought so much judgment and curse upon the land. Hezekiah knew that history, and he understood that the sequel to the restoration of true worship had to be the uprooting of false worship in the land. Once the cleansing of Jerusalem was complete, that's where the revival began, the servants of King Hezekiah turned their attention to the rest of the kingdom. And they did not stop with the kingdom of Judah itself. The disarray in the northern kingdom during this last reign of a king there meant that the frontier would be open to crossings. And so the servants of Hezekiah went into the territory of Ephraim and Manasseh, two of the tribes in the northern kingdom, and they carried on their religious reformation there, because people from those areas had come to Jerusalem to be part of the great Passover celebration of which we have already spoken. So you see, there was no thought of opening negotiations with the clergy, if you will, of the idolatrous religions. Those who undertook the mission to cleanse the kingdom and its neighboring territory of idolatry were not interested in any dialogue or compromise. The language of our text this evening is as vivid as it is direct. They broke in pieces. They cut down. They threw down. They destroyed. You don't have to wonder about the policy and the action that it entailed. They even went so far as to wipe out of existence an ancient relic, a historical artifact from the wilderness wanderings. The brazen serpent that God had directed Moses to make and to put on a pole, and that became there on that pole a type of Christ upon the cross. You read of that in John's Gospel, chapter 3. That brazen serpent had become, by the time of Hezekiah, an object of religious veneration. People burned incense to it, offered prayers up to it. And Hezekiah knew it had to go. That's how far these actions went. They saw the brazen serpent, and people would have said, well, you know, that's very old. We'll have to call down to the Historical Preservation Council and see what they have to say about that. Well, there was no such organization to save it. And Hezekiah said, it has become an idol. It must go. Anything that represented idolatry toward it, Hezekiah was unforgiving. In our text this evening, we find the young king then leading his revived people, his awakened people, in smashing false religion. Smashing false religion. Now, we are on the verge of this year's commemoration of Reformation Month. We're not beginning it this evening, but we're on the verge of it before too long. The commemoration of that work of God's grace, that spiritual revival. It was, at the end of it all, a revival of religion in the days of the Protestant Reformation. And, of course, this year's commemoration will serve as the launch for the marking of the 500th year since that work's historical beginning. That is, in October we begin the 500th anniversary year of the Reformation. If there is a leading characteristic of the work of the Reformation, it has to be that the reformers, at least, certainly this is true, in the first generation of the Reformation knew that no quarter could be given to the false religion of Rome. Now, I often wonder how they would have responded had they been on the scene during the 20th and 21st centuries and heard so-called evangelicals to suggest that there's not really that much difference between what Protestants believe and what Roman Catholics believe. To the extent of which they were capable, the leaders of the Reformation sought not only the revival of true religion, but also the destruction of that which was false. So they did not say to people who had been converted to the truth of the gospel that it was certainly understandable if they would stay in the church of their fathers. The reformers then were following the example of King Hezekiah and his servants, as we find it set before us in our text. So this text, indirectly and directly, sets before us three actions that Hezekiah led his people to follow. First, preparing for spiritual warfare. Preparing for spiritual warfare. Now, already in Jerusalem, as appears very vividly in 2 Chronicles 30, there was a clear and stern approach to dealing with that which was false, which the previous king, Ahaz, instituted. If you turn back to chapter 30, and to verse 13, we read, "And there assembled at Jerusalem much people to keep the feast of unleavened bread in the second month, a very great congregation." That was the Passover. "And they arose and took away the altars that were in Jerusalem." Who set up those altars? It was Ahaz. "And all the altars for incense took they away and cast them into the brook Kidron." The geography of Jerusalem is that on the eastern side of the city, just outside the walls, there is a fairly steep drop-off to the valley of the brook Kidron. So the people went through Jerusalem, and wherever they found one of these altars that Ahaz had erected, they knocked it down. They took it away. They carried it to the wall, through the gate, and they threw it down the slope into the brook. And they went through the whole city and they did that. That was what happened at the time of the Passover. Now, what was happening in our text was they were going to take that same approach outside the city of Jerusalem, outside the city of David, to the other parts of the kingdom of Judah. And they weren't going to stop there. Some people from Ephraim and Manasseh, as we can read in chapter 30, visited Jerusalem at the time of the Passover. They were invited to come, and they did. And so the people of Judah sensed there would be an open invitation from them to enter those parts of the decrepit northern kingdom and to eradicate false religion in those areas as well. But the key to this point of our text is its opening clause. "Now, when all this was finished," when all this was finished, that is, when the cleansing of Jerusalem from false religion was finished, and the true worship of the true and living God was taking place again in the city, then the way was open for spiritual battling elsewhere. So the preparation for spiritual warfare was the assertion that worship must be devoted only to the true God. That what the first commandment said was how they were to live. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. And they also knew, according to God's word, that such worship must be according to that which God himself has prescribed. For God has said how he is to be worshipped. In the reign of David, there was an admission of this truth in that when they moved the ark, they did not move it as God instructed. And David said, this breach, the death of a man, came upon us because we did not seek God after the due order. So here's a powerful lesson for us in our own time, because so much energy in our own time seems to be expended on debating what are called the worship wars. Now, there is no great mystery here. To worship God aright means that you understand who he is. And you understand that he is not magnified by the concepts of the popular culture that have made so many incursions into evangelical Christianity. The reason that Christianity is so weak in America is that American believers tend to buy into the lie that to be successful, you have to employ the world's philosophy and methodology and engage in the amusement of people rather than in their instruction and edification. When people are taken up more with sensual gratification than they are with the glory of the holy God of the universe, they are not going to be ready for the kind of spiritual warfare of which we read here. A lot of people in so-called churches today are not going to be around when it comes to spiritual warfare. Hezekiah led the people in giving attention to their own spiritual needs first, and only then were they ready for the huge task that lay before them. And that's the second thing that we find in our text, identifying spiritual apostasy. They had to identify spiritual apostasy. They had to find out where it was, and they had to name it for what it was. Everything of which we read in our text was part of the practice of that religion that was a departure from the truth. Notice those things of which we read here. Images. God said, you're not to set up any graven image. You're not to make an image of anything in heaven or in earth or under the earth. You're not to make an image of anything. And beyond that, you're not to bow down yourself to those images. You're not to serve those images. So here were images that were being worshipped. The groves, those were places that were set apart for worship, where trees were set up so that you couldn't really see what was going on inside them. And all kinds of wickedness went on inside those places. The high places, Those were the altars that were set apart to the worship of the false gods like Baal and Ashtoreth. It was a departure from the truth. And specifically, it was religion that God forbade in his word. Let's turn back to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7. Let's read beginning at verse 1. When the Lord thy God shall bring thee into the land whither thou goest to possess it, and hath cast out many nations before thee, the Hittites and the Girgashites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than thou, and when the Lord thy God shall deliver them before thee, thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. He is forbidding compromise. Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son. Why? Because this kind of intermarriage is always the devil's way of breaking down the truth. For they will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy thee suddenly. But thus shall ye deal with them. Ye shall destroy their altars and break down their images and cut down their groves and burn their graven images with fire. For thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God. The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all the people that are upon the face of the earth. Now turn a few chapters forward to chapter 12. And verse 1. These are the statutes and judgments which ye shall observe to do in the land, which the Lord God of thy fathers giveth thee to possess it, all the days that ye live upon the earth. Ye shall utterly destroy all the places wherein the nations which ye shall possess served their gods. Not make other ones, but destroy all those that where they serve their gods, upon the high mountains and upon the hills and under every green tree, and ye shall overthrow their altars and break their pillars and burn their groves with fire, and ye shall hew down the graven images of their gods and destroy the names of them out of that place. Ye shall not do so unto the Lord your God. But every other god was to be destroyed. So God was warning the people against following the examples of the people who were around them. But what happened? The people of succeeding generations discarded those warnings. Look at 1 Kings chapter 14. 1 Kings chapter 14 records the sad history of what happened after Solomon's reign. Look at verse 21. Then Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city which the Lord did choose out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. And his mother's name, significantly, was Naamah, an Ammonitess. And Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins, which they had committed above all that their fathers had done. For they also built them high places and images and groves on every high hill and under every green tree. In spite of what God said through Moses in Deuteronomy. And we notice that always with this false religion comes the other thing in verse 24. There were also Sodomites in the land, and they did according to all the abominations of the nations which the Lord cast out before the children of Israel. You want to know why this nation in which we live has run after Sodomites? Why Sodomites have such influence in this land? It is because we have forsaken the true worship of the true God, and we have opened ourselves up to all other kinds of gods. Only now they have the names of so-called Christian music groups, other kinds of gods. We've opened ourselves up to that, and now we find the harvest being reaped in the country. The servants of Hezekiah, when they went out, they went looking for the trappings of false religion, and they found them. It was not a difficult search. And it is not hard today to identify spiritual apostasy. I read just yesterday, I think it was, in one place a story about a man. He's a prominent individual, the son of a prominent individual in evangelicalism. He complained that Christians today are relying too much on the Bible, that they've turned the Bible into its own God, that they say they always go to the Bible for all their authority. But when I hear that coming from a so-called evangelical, that is the voice of apostasy. When you hear suggestions, as you do now in many quarters, that there's not really that much difference between what we believe and what Romanists believe, that's the voice of apostasy. It's not hard to identify. So the people identified those signs wherever they found them, and they knew what to do with them. And that's the third thing in the text. Pulverizing spiritual perversion. Pulverizing spiritual perversion. They gave no quarter. They didn't go in and say, well, we know that you have set up all these altars, and some of them are very nice artistic pieces, and we don't want to hack them all to bits. Maybe we can sit down and work out a solution where you can use them to worship the true God. No, they gave no quarter. They had a mission. They were going to destroy it. They would not go back home until they completed this vital part of the revival. And we saw how far this pulverizing went. In 2 Kings 18, now we come back to that passage. In the middle of verse 4, we read that Hezekiah break in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made, for unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it, and he called it Nehushtan. Here is really the ultimate commentary upon how twisted, how perverted false religion is. It takes something that was designed to be a means of salvation, so that when people in the book of Numbers, when people were bitten by the serpents, Moses was to craft a brazen serpent and put it upon a pole, and whenever anybody looked to that serpent, he would be delivered from the effects of the serpent bites from which so many were dying. And in John chapter 3, we read that as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up. But here, they had taken this brazen serpent that was to be a picture of the sacrifice of the cross, And they turned it into an object of religious worship. We've got to have something to see. We know that God's supposed to be invisible, but we have to have something to see. So give us a statue. Fine, the serpent, that works, it's antique. And they burned incense to it. Hezekiah said, not anymore. He pulverized it. Much like Moses did with those two golden calves that the people had fashioned, that Aaron had fashioned. When he said, well, I threw all the gold in and out came the calves. Moses pulverized them and put the dust into the water and made the people drink it. There was the attitude that Hezekiah had. Not even that. If it's made into an item of false religion, not even that will survive. Hezekiah ordered it to be destroyed. Here was the perversion. False religion twisted that object and made it into an idol. Hezekiah said, it will no longer be around. This is the approach. The approach that Hezekiah took is the approach that we have to take in our hearts and in our churches toward false religion. We can't pretend that we can enter into an easy accommodation with it. In America, we agree to be tolerant. But in the church, we are intolerant when it comes to that which is false. The elders of the church in the New Testament were charged with being vigilant. Paul said to the Ephesian elders, you need to watch. You need to pay attention. Finally, we read in the text, the campaign was over. And only then did all the children of Israel return, every man to his possession, into their own cities. And what did they do when they went home, do you think? They gave God thanks that God had brought them a king who had set about the policy as soon as he became king of restoring true religion. They rejoiced in that. That was a blessing to that nation. They knew the truth of which we can read in the Psalms, righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people. They knew that truth. The revival under Hezekiah became the means of blessing for the land. He was, in that way, a type of Christ himself. Because Christ in his reign becomes a means of true blessing for his people. Hezekiah would face other challenges, and we shall read about them and speak about them in coming messages. He faced other challenges, but here at the beginning, he identified what was the top priority, that people had to be right in their hearts, or there could be no progress for the nation. That's true for America. If the people are not right in their hearts, there will be no progress for the nation. A nation that has turned away from God, the scriptures say, will be turned into hell. So then, let us follow the example set by the great Hezekiah and those who labored with him, And let us resolve that we will give no quarter either in our hearts and in our church to the forces of false religion. We will instead set Christ before us as the object of all our devotions.